Well, Mike, we've covered climate cases in the courts for some time now and have chronicled their agonizingly slow pace and often inconclusive outcomes. But there was a beautiful moment of clarity this month with the Montana Supreme Court upholding the landmark decision in the first ever youth climate lawsuit to go on trial in the U.S. And we covered the success of that case last summer, and now the Supreme Court has ruled in their favor on appeal. Can you tell us about the case, a brief history of it, and its significance, this Supreme Court ruling this month?
It's the Held versus Montana case. The significance is this is the first jury trial we've had about whether or not human activity causes climate change and whether the court has the right to or is bound to take action that would modify this global heating. And it's no small issue. I mean, 2024 will be the hottest year on record. The United States here is now the biggest oil producer in the world. We put out 13 million barrels of oil every day. It's a huge part of the economy. That's 20% of all the world's oil. And so, what this lawsuit has done practically is lead to the potential suspension of the construction of a natural gas plant in Montana. What's happening with using youth? Youth are people who are too young to vote, they can't affect change through the political process. First, the court found that they had standing to sue, and then found that the state, after a trial, violates their right to a clean and healthful environment under Montana's constitution. A judge declared that a Montana law proving this natural gas plant violated the right because Montana stopped. Who tried to stop all agencies from considering climate impacts when conducting environmental reviews? There was a trial, the first constitutional climate trial, had experts from oil companies, experts from plaintiffs, a lot of people, names are familiar to you from climate talks with Jim Hansen, people like that showed up, all kinds of experts. And ultimately, the judge wrote a 100-page opinion, which basically said that the state has a constitutional right. So other cases have relied on the public trust documents that basically the right to due process includes the right to life and liberty. It's infringed by the climate. But Montana has a very explicit part of its constitution devoted to the environment. It's the strongest decision on climate change issued by any court anywhere. It's very detailed. It's 100 pages. In every respect, the court agreed with the plaintiffs that fossil fuel combustion is the main cause of climate change, and that climate change is having all kinds of terrible health and environmental impact, which will get worse unless we stop fossil fuel emissions.
So, Mike, what do you think the arguments and counterarguments in play at the Supreme Court level? How did they differ from the trial? Because I watched the concluding arguments. Actually, it's quite interesting to watch them. You can watch them online on Vimeo. And it seemed like the arguments were the same as those at trial, although the attorneys for the state seemed to emphasize the overreach of the lower court ruling, and that there were enough ways of using the permitting process to protect citizens if there were concerns about the health impact of permits. And then the justices and several of them said, so like what would be an example of how citizens could influence this? But it seems like a replay in a way of the lower court. What is critically different about decisions at the Supreme Court level?
Well, you're talking about the Supreme Court of Montana. Yeah, well, it's finally like everything within the law, it's political. A good contrast is shown by what happened to the Juliana case. Same type of case brought in Oregon and Eugene. A really great district court judge ruling, Ann Aiken, ruled that it was a critical matter, the most important issue around, that the plaintiffs did have standing. But finally, the Ninth Circuit banned them from going forward, smushed the whole case.
Did it matter that the Giuliani case was with the federal government versus this with the state of Montana?
Well, legally, it mattered very little because the rationale of the Ninth Circuit in its Giuliani opinion was that plaintiffs, the kids there, had no standing to bring a claim for relief ordering the government to implement a plan to phase out fossil fuel emissions because the courts couldn't really do anything that would provide relief because no declaratory judgment is going to suffice to stop catastrophic climate change. The court basically threw up its hand and said, such a remedy is just beyond the power of an Article III court. They
And that
said,
there
well,
would have to be so many institutions at the federal government in providing relief, right?
they fled, as is not uncommon in the law, to a gross exaggeration of the remedy. They weren't being asked to stop all catastrophic climate change. They acted as if that was what the plaintiffs were demanding. But there are concrete measures that can be taken. There's a whole variety of measures that could be taken if there was a will enough to do it. China has, it's reprehensible in some ways with all the coal use and all the nuclear power use, but they've also done a tremendous amount of building of solar energy fields, some of them like many football fields the size, wind energy, and they have spent over $200 billion making it possible and easy to own an electric car in China. They've got tens of thousands of charging locations, getting rid of range anxiety. You can always find a place to charge your car.
Of course, they don't have to worry about the permitting process because they steamroll ahead with these things. And I know liberalizing the permitting process has also been a controversy among environmentalists with renewables. Do we really want to, how do we reform the permitting process? But here it seems like I think the general principle that the public has a right to participate in looking at the impacts on the health and welfare of citizens is a principle that could be taken into review of renewable permitting as well, could it not?
Sure, it could. I mean, China has the great advantage of being a steamroller, just as you said. They also got real results. The number of particulate matters in big cities in China is down over 15%. The air is markedly, even dramatically better in Beijing and Shanghai and Wuhan than it was 20 years ago. So this can be done. And in California, for example, they're trying to bring about good results by forcing cars to eventually, and not too long in the future, by 2035, get rid of all fossil fuels. And the EPA has given California exemptions from other requirements since the days of Richard Nixon and the EPA's first existence. They've let California have exceptions to clean air requirements in order to charge ahead and make requirements on cars, which are sold there in greater numbers than anywhere else, and more restrictive of the particulates they emit. Now, Trump, of course, has this within his sights. The US Supreme Court, which is now full of Trumpistas, has ruled against the EPA in major ways, holding it generally in about agencies of all sorts, most particularly the EPA, have limits on their powers. It's always unknown between when a legislature passes a law, then the executive branch of government carries it out. And what are going to be the details? The devil is always in the details. How far can they go in order to achieve the legislative intent? Well, Trump and the many members of the Supreme Court want to severely limit what an agency can do. At the same time, they want to limit the budget and the funding of this whole process. So, what's going to happen over the next year, 2 years, and 3 years in terms of cars, I think most decisively is going to go on in California. Can California continue to make ever more stringent rules about what emissions are permissible from cars?
Because the size of California's economy drives a lot of what happens elsewhere, right?
There are 15 states who have followed California's lead. This is a big chunk, in fact, maybe even more than half of the entire automobile industry. So it's a big deal. We've seen it's a big deal from the concrete results in the air. The air is dramatic improvement in China. We've seen it in Los Angeles, which was far worse in the 1970s than it is now. There are things that can be done. There are rules that can be passed. There are laws and there are constitutional rights that are only implemented and only become meaningful in a concrete way. And if the right to a clean air, to life and liberty, which is serious, particularly life, which is seriously impinged by fossil fuel emissions, then the judges have a right, even a duty, to take action. And the fact that they can't solve the whole problem does not mean they can't do something.
I was wondering about your thoughts on Montana's unique constitutional provision for guaranteeing or providing a healthy environment for citizens. And only a few other states have similar environmental provisions in their constitutions. How critical is that? And is it like many things in the law where you use what you have and that's what they have, but it's not the only legal anchor for these cases?
Well, it's a big help, no question about that. The fact that there is a specific provision in their constitution, and New York's is very good as well, addressing the environment directly makes it somewhat easier. But other states are not without remedy if they don't have a particular clause. All sorts of trust doctrines about maintaining a harm-free or a pollution-free environment are present in every state's law and arguably present in the US Constitution and the due process right. The rights to privacy, the rights to health, for example, threats to health, even for prisoners, if it's a deliberately malicious hospital, effectively shorten the lives of prisoners. Well, measures taken outside the prison in the larger society that affect people's health violate the existing constitutions. So there are legal remedies, but if there's a will, there is a way anywhere. But there's no doubt that that specific language in Montana is very encouraging. It was a big part of what the Montana Supreme Court ruled on. The fact that that clause had been added to the Constitution recently gave
And
real.
upheld, right?
Absolutely, yes.
You make a point that I think often gets lost in the worry about the world around us falling apart with each day. Their insurance companies are, of course, very worried about how much coastal space is uninhabitable, uninsurable, all kinds of weather effects that are also very expensive for the federal government. But you also emphasize that there have been gains in the history of the environmental movement. Even the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency itself came out of a social movement. And the flying into Los Angeles is different than it was when I was going to graduate school in the 1970s, and it was like descending into a mud puddle. This is an important point to emphasize that there have been gains where serious collective efforts supported by the state have intervened around environmental crises.
Well, the most discouraging thing to me right now is something that Jeffrey St. Clair included, along with his detailed discussion of all the environmental disasters around the world during the last year of 2024. And that is the
You're
growing
talking about
number.
a Counterpunch article?
He had a Counterpunch article on public dated December 20th, really excellent review of environmental disasters. If you have any doubt or question about the extent of climate change and what's resulting from the climate change that's going on, read his piece and Counterpunch. But he also includes there something that I've felt and is now articulated, in that there is a a growing despair among people, Democrats, young people, people who've been engaged by climate change, in the likelihood or possibility or political reality of any change. The fact that the climate is changing in a bad way is not seriously in dispute anymore. But whether or not people can do anything about it, people's sense has dropped from like 60% to 49% since 2018. There's a greater sense of despair on this question. And these things are cyclical. There have been moments of intense concern in the early 70s that led to the creation of the EPA. But there have been laggardly times, and I think now we're in a time that, despite storms that recently killed thousands of people on islands, two of the most severe hurricanes ever in Florida, fires in Canada that have not stopped for years, we're having all kinds of really dramatic climate change that's happening here and now, and people just seem to, rather than try to squarely address it, they're thinking that it's just something to adapt to.
Yeah, so movements have a way of emerging in unexpected times and places. So I think we will be seeing activism, and I think one of the developments that I think has been important over the last year, or even to the Black Lives Matter movement in recent years, is how many young activists are making connections between the military industrial complex, the vast investment in weapons, even the environmental impact of the horror and genocide in Gaza, racism and the structural racism in this country, including in the legal carceral system. So, but that makes it a very big project too, to call for reforms on something so big that calls for something more revolutionary in terms of how the economy is run and how we go about making things and living on this planet.
Well, everything is connected, absolutely. I mean, China has spent $230 billion over the last 13 years. We could have done that too, but we have to maintain troops in 85 countries around the world. We have hundreds of bases overseas. We have other places for our money. So we don't have $200 billion to create charging stations and develop an alternative to the fossil fuel system in the internal combustion engine.
So militarism is a big part of the problem.
Huge part. I think it's the center part. The cost of maintaining an empire is the biggest threat to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a point to conclude on today, Mike. We know not too much happy talk today. It's the end of the year, but we want to celebrate and raise a glass to these young plaintiffs who stayed with this case. It was very endearing seeing them all in the courtroom, including with the Montana Supreme Court. They were all there, and their attorney turned to them, and it must have been had some effect on those justices because they were quite a winsome bunch. Even though they're older now, they're still pretty young.
Well, it was a fabulous result with lots of juicy details that'll be reproduced in other climate-related litigation. So, yeah, things come and things go. We need to persevere until some event will happen, I think, that will trigger a massive wave of support for stopping the global heating process to the extent that we can do it.
Okay. Have a good holiday, and we'll see you on Left in the Law in the new year. We'll have plenty to cover.
We will. Take care, Jen.
Thanks, Mike.